Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the studio, we have another candidate who's going to be involved in the primary here in the state of Illinois later this month on the 16th. In the 15th Congressional District on the Democratic side, there will be a contest. We have two candidates. One of them in the studio this morning, his name is Ralph Langenheim. The other is David Gill, and he's going to be on the program next week. One of them will then go on to meet incumbent Congressman Tim Johnson, a Republican. He does not have a challenger in the primary. And we wanted to give you the opportunity, you folks who are listening this morning who live in the 15th District, to talk with both of these Democrats and ask your questions and get some idea of who they are. So that's what we're all about here. In the run-up to primaries and general elections, we invite as many candidates as we can and as are willing to be here on the show to talk. And we're pleased that Ralph Langenheim is with us here this morning. Just a little bit about him. He's a retired professor of geology at University of Illinois and is a current member of the Champaign County Board. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Why do you want to run for Congress?
Why do I want to run for Congress? Yeah. Well, I've always been interested in politics, and while I was a professor for all those years, I didn't have the time for it. I was busily pursuing tenure and fame and fortune and all that kind of stuff. But when I was retired and faced with a lifetime sitting in front of a television, I decided that that wasn't it for me. And when I was asked to run for the board, I ran, and I've been there now for 6 years.
Okay. There are a number of things we could talk about. I think as I've tried to talk to candidates, you try to hit some of the big issues. I don't know if there's anything in particular that you think deserve to be higher at the top of the list than others. What's most important to you think, for people to be thinking about and talking about?
Well, that's a very difficult question because there are many questions which are terribly important, and I hate to single out one of them. Our economic problems, our problems in foreign policy and with our allies, energy, both the quantity and quality, the environment. There are severe environmental problems. The more people there are, the more the stress on the environment, and it's going to continue. Health care, I'm conscious of that. I have a few little minor ailments, and I'm paying money for some prescription drugs. I was able to save 75% of the cost of them by picking up a refill in Torremolinos in January. So that's important. Civil rights, I've been involved in all of those things.
And I can ask you some specific questions about individual of these things.
And I would appreciate that.
Maybe we start out talking about the economy. We came through a recession. Things last year started to look a little bit better, although at the end, the growth rate in the economy at the end of the year was pretty anemic. I think now they're saying maybe 4.5%. And in addition, there's a lot of concern about jobs and the fact that Democrats have made a lot of the fact that during the time that the president has been president, we've lost a lot of jobs. And even though we've gained some, nothing to offset the kind of loss. So we come down to the question, what, if anything, can the Congress do to try to stimulate the economy and encourage the creation of new jobs?
Well, one thing we could probably do, and which would be advantageous, would be to slap a graduated tax on corporate flight. In other words, if a company moves its business to Indonesia because they're low labor costs, we should tax the income from that proportional to the discrepancy between the environment they fled to and the environment that they left. I think that is one way of getting at it. Of course, the other side of that is the last time the world went into a protectionist mode, facing similar situation, by the way, the ultimate result was the Second World War. So we have some problems there.
President, his main way of attacking the issue of the economy and trying to stimulate it is to cut taxes. And he did one of his main things that he said he wanted to do as he was campaigning was to cut taxes, and he managed to get that through the Congress. It's temporary, though. It'll sunset if the Congress doesn't make that permanent. What do you think that the Congress should do?
It should speed up the sun.
So you do not favor making the tax cuts permanent?
I do not. I favor modifying them instanter. The graduated income tax is the means by which we remove the tremendous discrepancy in low-income people and high-income people in the 1890s and in the early part of the 20th century and in the 1930s. And the removal of that discrepancy has resulted in an obscene difference between what the top layer is making and what the vast mass is making. The poor have been ground down to a nubbin, and they're in the process of converting a good deal of the middle class to the poor. Mm. So, yes, I think that that tax cut should be severely revamped.
Yeah. You talked about the fact that you would like to see something happen that would discourage American businesses from exporting jobs.
That's right.
Is there anything that you think that government can do, that federal government can do, to actually encourage the creation of new jobs?
Well, from the days of the Homestead Act, which go way back, the government has selectively subsidized various elements of the economy, and it's done it by direct subvention. It's done it by manipulating the tax code. And although we're constrained by the trade agreements into which we've entered, I think we should be subsidizing some of our industries.
Let me introduce again our guest, because I think actually I didn't neglect it right at the beginning to give the telephone numbers, and I certainly want to make sure that people who are listening
Good.
Know that the idea here is also for folks there out in the 15th who might be voting in this primary to call in and ask questions to reporters. They get to talk to candidates all the time. The idea of the show is that voters can talk with the candidate. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. That's for local folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455.
To come back to what the government might do, a specific thing that the government might do, which is a sort of a double-edged benefit, is raise the standards on coal power plant gas emissions to the point where any coal that you burn has to go through a scrubber. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, we get nice clean air like we're getting out of the Abbott power plant. And also, we create a situation where Western low sulfur, high ash, low BTU coal hauled 1,000 miles becomes less competitive, and we see jobs opening up in our domestic bituminous coal industry. And a lot of it would come right here in this district.
Hmm. One of the issues that you mentioned right at the beginning and a lot of people concerned about is access to healthcare and cost. And one bottom line issue is the fact that we have in this country something over 40 million people, I think, that don't have health insurance. What do we do about that?
Single pay federal health insurance.
You favor that approach, something sort of like what Canada has?
Yes. Similar to the Canadian arrangement or the British arrangement, which, of course, get terribly bad press here because a lot of that press is stimulated by people who are making a profit out of the present health care arrangements, the insurance companies, the drug companies, and some of the for-profit hospitals.
Is there some fundamental way in which you think that Americans misunderstand what a system like that would be like? You think misconceptions that they have that you would say, well, that's not really true?
Well, we're fed the line that the waits are for, you have to wait forever to get service, and that service is limited. I can't imagine anything more inconvenient than the present arrangement. I'm in under the university's health insurance, and I'm using Carl Clinic, and I have to wait, and I have problems, and I get exasperated with it. Talking to people who've lived under those systems, I find that the inconvenience is grossly exaggerated. Now, the question of the quality of care, there's a thing called triage. When you have a bunch of wounded people, you look at them, you decide which ones are going to survive, and you work with them, and those that are unlikely to survive or unlikely to be happy when they survive, you let them die. And that's a pretty hard-nosed thing, and it revolts people. But I think we have to do that in health care. I don't think, for example, I'm 80 years old. I shouldn't get a liver transplant. It costs a heck of a lot, and the return on the investment is going to be minimal. So that's one thing that gets into the health care business. We talk about you can't get this fine service in these the Canadian system, for example. Well, you can get it, but they do have to balance their resources against what's possible and against the outcome. And I think we must do that.
How do we pay for that?
How do we pay for it? Well, if you read the kind of people that write in the AARP, you're told that the increase in payroll tax that would be required to support that, or the tax that required to support that kind of a system, is minimal, really, in terms of the load. And again, the no tax, no more money, nowhere at no time type of folks sort of have the podium, and they speak loudly, and of course nobody really wants to put his hand in his pocket and pay taxes. But that's what it'll take. The European industrialized nations and Canada and Australia and New Zealand and those places all have universal health care. They all have solvent economies. They don't have corporate CEOs making $250 million a year, but the people in those countries are living happily and contentedly and within their within their resources.
Well, they also don't spend money on some of the things that we spend money on, like defense. Not to the extent that we do. It's some people would say it comes down to the fact that there's only so much money.
That's right.
Congress, Democrats, Republicans, no matter what the party is, everybody's willing to spend as long as they can get what they want for their constituents, and that difficult choices must be made. We have to look at how it is we're spending money and where we're spending it and say there are certain things we simply can't do. We've got to make choices. And in the past, we really haven't. We really haven't made the hard choices. And then there's simply some things we're going to have to say, we will spend money on this, but this over here, we're not going to do that. Are there some areas that you could point to, you could say, look, we're spending too much money in this area, and we're going to have to shift it, maybe shift it to spending on health care or retirement benefits or Medicare, whatever it is.
Precisely. We are, as we're continually being told and as we brag to ourselves about it, the sole surviving superpower responsible for maintaining law and order on the whole globe, and we do have a responsibility there. But I'm a long-term member of the Naval Reserve and a member of the Naval Institute. I read the proceedings. I know something about military baffle gab, and I know something about what one service thinks about its problems. And I can tell you this, that there are a number of programs, expensive programs, that are put forward not because the military wants them, but because the congressman that has the Pascagoula shipyard in his district wants them. And those things can be stopped, and, they can be stopped if you can force the congressman to stop them. But I would be a congressman that would want to stop those things. We can save a lot of money there without impairing our defense. For example, nobody wants to get into a Bradley fighting vehicle because it doesn't have enough armor and it isn't armed and it isn't fast enough. But it was a good buy for the congressman that had that in their district. That class of light frigates that was built in the 1980s. We're giving them away to any Navy that'll take them. They're big, expensive things which are essentially useless. And while we're on things that are big and expensive and essentially useless, I have plenty of contacts in the scientific community in this town, and one of them is a very important astronomer, electrical engineer, works with radio telescopes and things like that. He tells me that the academic scientists from coast to coast consider the manned space program to be very high expense with very little return. And this notion of mounting an expedition to Mars for the benefit of this political campaign is just what it appears to be. It's a political scam. We can save money on the manned space program. I'm told that robotics are more effective than astronauts riding a skyrocket and being controlled from Houston.
Let's go back to one other health care topic just before we get too far away from that, and that's the cost of prescription drugs. Do you think that there is some role there for the federal government to say to the drug manufacturers that they need to rein in their costs?
Well, yes. But what that is, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to go about it. But pressure can be brought to bear on them through tax, through modification perhaps of the patent law, through deals that such as the one that Blagojevich and some of the other governors have mounted to bring in prescription drugs from our prescription drugs at Canadian prices from Canada. The federal government has fought that tooth and nail. If they didn't fight it, then the threat would be there, and very, very quickly the drug companies would cut their prices. I know that the Roche company, which is an international drug company, a reputable drug company, can make my insulin stimulant at one-eighth, retail it at one-eighth the cost of what my local prescription costs are. And my doctor makes all the statements about, well, we don't control that, blah, 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 blah. But he says it's the same stuff mm-hmm. if you're getting it, if it hasn't been switched on you. Well, you can get a switch in a local pharmacy. We've had several instances where drugs which were being sold under prescription were under strength and so on and so forth. So, yes, those are a couple of ways you can bring pressure to bear.
It is illegal now for Americans to buy drugs in Canada. Would you favor changing that at least to say that if you want to go and buy your prescription medicines in Canada, you can?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. I guess I broke the law when I brought those pills in from Spain.
Yeah, I think you probably did.
I've done it twice now. Once I did it. The first time I did it, I went over there and I didn't bring these things along, and I really probably don't really need them, but... I didn't have any such thing, and I talked around a little bit, and I was taken down to this pharmacy, and I got them at one-eighth the price, you know? Mm. So this time, when I went over there, I had my pills with me, but I bought another batch.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ralph Langenheim. He is a member of the Champaign County Board. He's a retired professor of geology at University of Illinois and is also one of two Democrats that will be competing in the primary on the 16th in the 15th Congressional District. The other is David Gill, and he will be here on this program next week on Wednesday, March 10th in the 11 o'clock hour. So you'll have a similar opportunity to listen to him and talk to him. One of them, whoever wins the primary, will go on to meet the incumbent Tim Johnson in the general election. So this is your opportunity to ask questions. I will continue to ask questions, but if there's something that's very important to you, you should pick up the telephone and do the same. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I think we're getting somebody lined up here, ready to go, and... we will do that. And first caller is somebody calling on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them. Line one. Hello.
Morning. I got a question for you. May not have thought of, probably don't have a ready answer. But I'm a farmer, and you're talking about buying drugs from Canada. And we use a lot of pesticides that are kind of the same situation. In the United States, they be way higher cost than you can buy them anyplace else in the world, and the only difference is the label, which states the country. Would you be in favor of leveling out about everything that's the same formula?
I certainly would.
Thank you.
All right. You want to go any further on that?
No. It's as he puts it, it's the same problem. I wasn't aware of that problem. The advocates of free trade should certainly be in favor of that.
Well, okay. Glyphosate, Roundup's one of the ones that's been way cheaper in South America. I don't know if you know about it, but we're competing with them pretty heavily in the soybean market.
Yes, you are.
and you can buy glyphosate. At least I haven't been there. I can't personally say I've paid for it in South America, but I understand it that it's a mere fraction of the price we're paying for the same product in the United States, but yet we have to compete with them on the world market.
Let me ask you a question. Are these foreign things provided in foreign countries provided by the same company, or are they under license from our companies?
I understand they're provided by, they come out of exactly the same plant.
Okay, well, that seems to be the situation with the drugs. I'm glad to know about that. I'll scream and holler about it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk about Social Security, something that from time to time people raise the flag and say, look, the future of the system is in jeopardy. The concern particularly is that we're going to get to the point where there are more people who are retired and drawing benefits than there are younger people working and paying into the system. Are you worried about the future of Social Security?
Apparently, some modifications may be. Well, we can guarantee any system is going to be need to be modified over the years. I'm not at all concerned about the Social Security pricing itself out of the market. There are lots of things can be done. Moderate increases in the eligibility age. After all, the eligibility ages were set when the life expectancy was far lower. Retirement ages were far lower. We can hike those up. That'll save some money. I'm opposed to means tests. I'm opposed to putting any part of it into Wall Street. That was very popular when we had a bull market. Well, we've had a bear market since then, another bull market. Maybe people realize that if you put your investments into stocks and bonds, you're likely to lose them. Social Security was set up as a minimal support level for everybody and financed by everybody, and it should be financed by everybody. The upper limit at which you do not have to contribute out of your income, it should be applicable to your entire income. The wealthy should pay more for it. It's an insurance program, basically, run by the government.
So this proposal that I think the president made and other Republicans favor, it hasn't gone anywhere, but I don't think he's given up on the idea that particularly younger people who are coming into the system should be able to take some of that money that goes into the system and self-direct that with limitations. Say, what? You know, you could put it into a one of these five mutual funds. Essentially, that is, they're saying something like that.
Sure.
So you don't think that's a good idea?
I don't think that's a good idea because people are not sufficiently disciplined, and young people have a different attitude towards their retirement than people who are middle aged or people who are elderly. On my first real job, when I was an instructor at Coke College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I was told I had to get into Social Security, but at that time you didn't have to do it right away, and I kicked and bucked and tried to keep every penny I had rather than contributing to Social Security, and that's a young person's attitude. I never felt that I would go from 24 to 81 with all of that implies. Mm-hmm. So no, I think the Social Security should be a compulsory program. And it should be operated by the government, and it should not be subject to the speculative fluctuations of stocks and bonds and other investments of that sort.
President Bush has proposed a reform in immigration, creating essentially what would be a guest worker program for the United States, making it possible for people to come, people who are either here already to be here legally work for 3 years, or somebody in another country, if they wanted to apply to do that, they could do that. Although it would not apparently make it any easier for them to become a citizen or make it any smooth the process at all, it would just be essentially a temporary work permit. What do you think about that?
Those people are made hostages to their employers, and a hostage to an employer is at the mercy of that employer, and employers don't have a very good record in treating such people. And again, I have a personal experience. Back in the days when I was doing field work in central Nevada and camping out, for one summer I shared a campsite with a Basque sheep herder. Under the terms of the McCarran Act, Basque sheep herders could come to the United States, and as long as they worked as sheep herders, they could stay. If they went into town and opened a restaurant, they were deported. This poor guy had been stuck out in the sticks. If food and water, food was brought to him, he was camped where there was water, and he hadn't been to town in a year and a half. That's, I think, rather inhumane treatment. We hauled him into town one night. He got thoroughly inebriated and so on and so forth, but that's it. The people that would come in under this guest worker business would be in severe difficulty. Take a look at what's happening to the Turks that came to Germany as guest workers. They don't need them anymore, so they're tossing them out. Hmm. Some of them are married to German citizens. They're tossing them out anyway. That's the kind of abuse that program is open to. There must be a better way.
Yeah. So you don't think that it's possible to design enough safeguards into the program so that wouldn't happen?
No, I don't. Hmm.
All right. We have, I think we're getting another caller lined up here. I just want to make sure the people listening know that their questions are welcome, too, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to talk with in Fisher, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
The incumbent, Timothy Johnson, prior to the lead-up to the war in Iraq, said he was privy to information that would oblige him to vote for the resolution authorizing the president to declare war. Since then, we've seen that possibly this information was in error. So my question would be, what would you do to take steps to see that Congress receives correct and vital information? And two, what would you do to restore a more clear balance of power between the executive branch and the legislative branch? Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I would certainly demand that information. People in Congress have demanded it and not got it. There are ways of bringing pressure to bear on a president in a situation like that. If the president is outside the law, you can impeach him. I don't think we'd have to go that far.
If it turns out that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, then does that mean that it was a mistake? Or would you have said it was a mistake in any case to go into Iraq?
Well, in a situation like that, and this is common to many similar situations, you have a choice. It's a mistake. It's dishonest. It's a lie. Or the man that's making the statement isn't competent to judge. And all three of those possibilities reflect rather severely on the perpetrator.
Well, if it's possible to put yourself into the frame of mind of the Congress at the time the vote was taken, knowing what we thought we knew then, would you have voted up or down on the Iraq War?
I was opposed to it from the beginning. It's the wrong war at the wrong time for the wrong reason. Now, we had the Western world has legitimate concerns about what was going on in Iraq, but we could have handled this much more effectively by working through the UN or working through a true coalition in which we did, in fact, compromise with our allies and arrived at a common purpose.
Are you satisfied with what we're doing in the way of homeland security?
I think we're infringing on our civil rights to an unacceptable extent. And again, this has happened before. It happened after the Second World War with the McCarthyite era. It happened after the First World War. During the Harding administration, it happens every time. So far, we've always managed to wake up before we've instituted a dictatorship of the informed, and I'm just hoping that we'll wake up in time to prevent that this time.
Yeah. Well, after September 11th, 2001, the Congress passed this package of legislation called the Patriot Act.
Yes.
And a lot of people, as you say, are concerned particularly about how it affects civil liberties. Some people in the administration want to actually even go further.
Yeah, sure.
And some people say, no, we really ought to actually revisit Patriot Act and perhaps get rid of some parts of it. I mean, are there parts of it that you think are okay and parts not? Would you want to scrap the whole thing?
No, I'd want to sort through it and retain those things which are consonant with our traditional values, but also address the different the differing conditions that, this particular emergency imposed upon us. For example, should this be a war? Is it a war? Or should it be a matter of law enforcement? We have other countries that have lived continuously with terrorism, the British with their Irish problem, for example, and they have restricted their civil liberties to a certain extent, but not in the same way we have. I think it's one of the wonderful things about the British system is that the Prime Minister is standing up and answering those questions. I listen to that and enjoy. I'd love to get – I can't imagine our president in that situation.
Yeah, it's pretty entertaining, isn't it?
Yes.
We have some other callers, both in Urbana. First, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good to hear you were against the war in Iraq. I'm no fan of Tim Johnson, so I'm happy to hear of anybody opposing him. about the FCC, though, Dennis Hastert up north had a lot to do with letting the, the FCC increase the ownership percentage provisions. And since my cable bill just went up, I was just curious how you come down on that issue. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I think we should replace deregulation with re-regulation. Deregulation of the communication system has resulted in better service. Deregulation of the utilities has resulted in what we see with Illinois Power. All of those laws that they have been repealing and changing were passed in the 30s or in the 1920s or even in the 1890s or 1910s to address the problems that we're now restoring to ourselves. We're getting those problems back. Does that answer your question?
The caller rang off, so okay. I guess we can hope. And, of course, he could always call back and do a follow-up.
Sure.
So you would favor action by the Congress to counter this the relaxation in the ownership rules that the caller was referring to. Essentially, what happened was the FCC came along and said that, well, you can now own – the number of stations that the networks could own was bumped up, and the number of situations at which in one community one entity could have television station and could have newspaper and so forth. And some people are very concerned about this concentration of ownership in the media. So you would say you'd want to go back and do something about that?
I would want to restore the limitations, yes. And I also, again, in terms of balancing the budget, I see no objection to a tax or a fee for the use of portions of the radio spectrum.
Hmm. Now, that's a pretty revolutionary idea. It's as long as there's...
Well, we do own it, and we do license it.
It's just been given away to the stations.
Yeah, sure. We gave away a resource to get those stations started, and those stations are now using it to our social disadvantage, according to most of us, many of us. I shouldn't say most of us. I speak for myself.
All right, let's go to another Urbana person. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, if you were elected to the Congress, what committees might you like to serve on, and what would you like to focus on in your time in the Congress?
Well, I have expertise in certain fields. I have a military expertise. I have an expertise in geology, which is applicable to energy and to environment. And I was born on campus and lived on campus all my life, so I know something about education. I would want to be on committees that dealt with those things.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Again, other people who are listening, if you have questions, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We haven't really talked about energy policy. Where do you think we should be going with it? And I would expect there would be fundamental ways in which you would depart from the kind of strategy that the White House has kind of laid out.
Well, yeah, I imagine I would. I approach energy from the point of view of a geological scientist, something about resources, something about needs. I also am concerned with the amount of energy that we use. Conservation should be instigated, and it can be done in simple ways like raising the gasoline tax or having a horsepower tax, which is graduated, that'd get the SUVs off the road for most of them without doing something dictatorial. I'm not an evangelist about the energy, but I'm well aware that we need tremendous amounts of energy, and that if we're going to bring the rest of the world up to a reasonable standard of living, we're going to need all the energy we can get. So I'm for getting to renewable energy resources. I favor the encouragement of windmills and solar power and low head hydropower and perhaps even tidal power, although that's environmentally rather obnoxious, but it works. These things work, and they can be made more effective. But I'm also aware of their limitations. The best estimates that I get from people that I think know are that we could perhaps get maybe 20% at most of our electrical power from wind, so that's not going to do it. So we have to worry about things like nuclear power and the fossil fuels with a more pragmatic attitude. Now, I've already said something about the coal business. Coal, we have a 200-year supply of coal. We can burn it without poisoning the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide problem is something else, which I can give you a long lecture on that, too. So coal, the use of coal, will be a good bridge to renewable resources. Eventually, we're going to have to get all of our energy from renewable resources because the non-renewable resources will be used up. Hmm. So that's sort of pretty general, and it's not going to satisfy anybody. I probably made every voter in the district mad at me with that one.
Do you think that there's a place for nuclear generation in the mix?
Well, take a look at nuclear generation. We've had one notable accident with nuclear generating in this country, Three Mile Island. There has been no verified health problem from that. There are those who say there is a health problem. There are others that say no, and the matter is open. So it's clean, and it can be controlled, and it should be approached on a cost-benefit basis, not money cost, but social cost-benefit basis. So I'm not going to stand up here and say no. I'm not also not going to say no. I'm also not going to say we should convert our power system entirely to nuclear power or any part of it. I want to see specifics, and I'll make my judgment then, and I will do it in the light of my knowledge, the advice that I can get, the good advice that I can get, and my own sense of conscience, civic conscience. And that's all you can expect of any congressman. If he tells you otherwise, he's blowing smoke.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Ralph Langenheim. He's a Democrat who will be competing in the primary here later this month in the 15th Congressional District. There is a contest here on the Democratic side of things. There are two Democrats. He is one of them, and the other is David Gill. And he will be on this program next week, Wednesday, March 10th, 11 a.m. For the same exercise, you'll have an opportunity to talk with him. And then one of them, whoever wins the primary, will go on to meet the incumbent, Republican Tim Johnson, in the general election. So this is your chance to ask questions of the candidate. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Savoy, line 2.
I hope that nobody has asked this, but do you stand in favor or do you stand opposed to the second nuclear reactor proposed to be built at Clinton Power Plant?
I have not seen a case made for it that convinces me, so I'm not in favor of going ahead with it at this time. I'm also unwilling to say that there shall never be a second unit at Clinton.
Would you support a second unit at Clinton?
If a social cost-benefit analysis convinces me that it is desirable, I'll support it. But I have to be convinced of that.
Who would need to do that analysis?
I would call on scientists and medical people and probably risk analysts, and I would consult the history of the operation of nuclear power plants in this country and elsewhere. That's all I can say.
So right now you're opposed to it, but in the future you would have to do that analysis.
Yes. I'm not convinced that it's necessary, and I'm not pushing to have it done. Okay?
Great. Thank you.
All right. To Champagne and Line 1. This is our next caller. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I'd like to know your views on family values, marriage between a man and a woman only, abortion, and stem cell research. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Okay. A marriage between a man and a woman. As a matter of fact, there are two aspects to marriage as we customarily speak of it. There is the civil side of it, which is a contract between two people to share their resources, etc., etc., etc. And then there is a religious contract, which is entered into in the church to which you belong or within the group to which you belong. In some countries, France, for example, the civil service is required. You have to go before the clerk and get it, and the clerk marries you. And then you can, or it's your option to enter into a religious affair. I see no objection to civil union whatsoever. And I see no objection to people within their congregations in the broad sense or their non-congregation calling what they have as marriage. So, that's how I stand on that. Now, what was the other one?
The other questions were abortions. You want to know what you feel about that?
An abortion's between a man, or excuse me, between a woman and her doctor. I'm a choice person.
All right. And stem cell research.
Stem cell research. Stem cell research is a viable procedure by which great good, medical good, can be achieved. And it does not have to involve anything that violates my moral strictures, and so I'm in favor of it.
Hmm. The president and apparently some other people feel that gay marriage should be banned by law. There are apparently some legislatures where their number of the members think that it should as well. Would you, for example, if a constitutional amendment came before the Congress that said no gay marriage, how would you vote on that?
Well, I would vote against it, and my opinion is pretty much that of John McCain's. That'll come into Congress, but it'll never pass. And we have an item in the Bill of Rights that separates church and state. The religious side of marriage is not to be tampered with by the state.
All right. We have another caller here on our line number 2, and that's Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the nuclear power issue somewhat. I don't know if you've done your opposition research, but what I've learned over time is that Tim Johnson was the biggest recipient of money from Exelon, the corporation that, though there's been such a shuffle going on, I think they're still the operators of the current plant.
Yes, they are.
And they got $23 million of federal money from the Department of Energy, I guess it came through. It might have been Department of Commerce, to help them fill out the paperwork, basically, to do the construction, to file for the construction permit. So not only do we have all the other subsidies of nuclear power, like the limited liability on catastrophic accidents and all the other research that was done in advance and the help that they've gotten through DOE and the AEC when that was around, NRC, all of the alphabet soup, that we actually have a federal policy of subsidizing this corporation to the extent of helping them fill out the forms and do the paperwork and do the studies, et cetera, for whatever other kind of plant. I think that I can get you to say that you kind of object to that in the long line of, and maybe you would comment on all the other subsidies of nuclear power you would object to. Can you handle that?
I don't know. I can certainly object to the subsidizing of direct business expenses, which is what you were talking about. I am in favor of subsidies for the study of the practicality of any energy source, and that includes nuclear. There is an energy source here. Can that energy be utilized to the benefit of society as a whole? And that is a valid thing to subsidize. The notion that corporations are inherently evil, which is what some people drive at, is not so. Corporations are organizations of people that have gathered together to accomplish a purpose. They're an essential element in our modern society because some of our purposes are so large that individuals are not able to carry the load. Corporations need to be regulated. They can be abused. Does that take care of your question?
No. Well, I don't think they're inherently evil. I think the current situation of limited liability that corporations have, they're actually licensed, or originally the intention was, and you can go back to the guy that wrote the Invisible Hand thesis, and he was already cautioning people against the, I think they called them concerns at the time because of the language, but he was worried about the concentration power and money in what we would now call corporations. So it's not inherent to anything, but I think the current business climate, business structure that is so incredibly corrupt at this point and inefficient, perhaps more inefficient than a lot of governmental concerns, I think it should be pretty clear that we can make an attack. I wasn't asking for an inherent condemnation of corporations, but subsidize and as far as balancing, I could get you to say that nuclear power has been subsidized to a large extent past even coal, probably, though that would be. But certainly the other kinds of renewable resources haven't been given the kind of research and support that they ought to have. So what, maybe we can agree on that, and I think it's quite at the end of the show. So,
well, no, we can't quite agree with that. I think in terms of the magnitude of the resource and the magnitude of its contribution to our energy supplies, it's difficult to say that something like wind power, for example, has not been subsidized to the extent that coal or nuclear power has been subsidized.
That's a bit tautological, isn't it?
Perhaps.
The extent to which that it's deployed has to do with how well it's being subsidized to some extent. So.
Yeah, that's true. But one time, wind power was our chief source of energy in the days of sail and windmills.
But there are systems now that you could store hydrogen and with wind power use it when you need it. There's a system that is even combined with Missouri. They actually, it's the company that's likely to get the current nuclear plant where they pump water up during off-peak loads with the nuclear energy.
Yeah, you're talking.
Well, there are all sorts of wonderful things.
Water storage.
Do.
That's right.
But I also think that we should advocate.
And that's been subsidized, by the way. Pump water storage got a big subsidy back in the 50s.
Well, I would like for you to say that you might at least consider subsidizing, working towards policies that subsidize decentralized power sources. How about that?
I think anybody that's got a windmill in his backyard should be able to reverse the flow in his meter.
Well, that's good. Thanks a lot.
Right. No problem at all with that.
We have maybe enough time for one more caller, at least, if you'd like to talk with our guest. Ralph Langenheim, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a question about education. And again, one of the things the president said when he was campaigning was that he was really interested in trying to improve education. And the big buzzword, of course, is accountability. So he came up with this thing that passed the Congress that's called No Child Left Behind, which has gotten kind of mixed reviews from educators. And in fact, there are some school systems where they've said, well, we just as soon opt out of this because it doesn't make any sense to us. What do you think about this package that basically says you've got to set targets for the students, you've got to test to make sure they're meeting them, and then whether or not they meet them, that's going to have a lot to do with what kind of support you end up getting from the federal government for your schools. Is that a good approach or not?
In part. Certainly students should be tested. They should be tested, perhaps not to the extent that they're being tested in some places now, but testing and evaluating following that test is appropriate. And if the school is in fact failing in the sense that it isn't able to handle the problems that it's got, then one should look into why that might be the case. And the problem that you have in a big city school system where there's no money and there's no parental support to the students is very different from the kind of problem you have in the city of Urbana, for example, which had its schools all condemned. I think a little common sense with regard to this is called for. And I want to go on record. I am heartily in favor of public schools. I'm against vouchers. I'm against anything that would encourage people or would give governmental support to non-public schools.
Well, I think that we're about the point where we're going to have to leave it. Any last thing that you'd like to mention?
Last thing? Well, I greatly appreciate your vote.
All right. Ralph Langenheim is our guest. He is a member of the Champaign County Board. He's a Democrat, one of two that will compete in the primary on the 16th in the 15th congressional district. And one of them will go on to meet the incumbent, Representative Tim Johnson. By the way, the other Democrat in this race, David Gill, will be here on this program next week on Wednesday, March 10th in the 11 o'clock hour. You'll get a chance to talk with him. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.